Hello, listeners of the Line Podcast, for this recording on April 26, 2024, with your hosts, Jen Gerson, myself, and Matt Gurney. We've got so much to talk about today. This week, Pierre Poilievre visits the baddies, and the predictable Twitter outrage ensues. We're going to ask what the hell is going on at the CBC again, and we're going to get into a little bit of the latest crazy in Alberta this week at the Line Podcast.
Well, we got a lot to talk about. Shout out everybody who came out to see us in Calgary. That was a lot of fun. That was an absolute blast. And thank you to DNS Advocates, our lawyers who sponsored the event. And also a special thank you to Ken Bozenkool. He gave us some logistical support that helped us pull off that event as well. We're very grateful to him for that. And if you had fun in Calgary, or if you were sad you couldn't make it to our event in Calgary, maybe you can make it to Edmonton. We have just announced last night at the time of this recording that our next in-person event is coming up in Alberta's capital city. That's coming up on June 6th. So that's about 6 weeks, call it away. Jen, this is going to be a lot of fun. You've done the heavy lifting on this event, and by the way, you did the heavy lifting on Calgary too. Like you're taking charge of your own backyard, so to speak. You did a great job. Tell everybody just in a couple of seconds here, what do we have coming up in Edmonton in about 6 weeks?
Sure. So the Line is co-hosting this event called Is Canada Prepared for the Next Shitstorm? Please don't bleep me out. We're co-hosting this event with the Max Bell School of Public Policy, and we are going to have, it's going to be a panel discussion with Lisa Raitt, with Trevor Toom, and also with economist Chris Reagan. We're going to ask ourselves how economically prepared Canada is for the absolutely inevitable disaster that is to come, given that we are in the darkest of all dark timelines, whether that disaster be pandemic, war, economic collapse, Bitcoin takeover, who the hell knows? So we're going to be discussing all those kinds of economic potentialities. And also, this is going to be part of a broader speaker series that the Line is doing that we hope will coalesce into a kind of mini manifesto to help guide a future government in making significant reforms to Canada to get us out of the shitter that we are currently in. So I think it's going to be a really interesting event. It's going to be $40, but with that, you're also getting drinks and you're getting some delicious appetizers as well. A really entertaining and fun night out, little chat and meet and greet with the event's co-host and moderator, you and me, and some chat time. So it's going to be a lot of fun. If you are going to be in Edmonton for June 6th, do consider checking it out. I think it's going to be a blast. Our last event was a blast. This event is also going to be a blast.
I've been assured that no one parties like Edmonton people party. So looking forward to that. No, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's been too long since I've been in Edmonton. So in about 6 weeks, I'll be back out with you, Western Canada. You'll make a Westerner of me yet. No, I'm just kidding. You won't.
Snob. Trump is snob. Let's talk about Pierre and his little his little spontaneous spot, his spontaneous little drop in to a protest in Nova Scotia. Matt, tell us all about that.
So this is one of those stories, Jen, and there's versions of this that pop up time to time in my line of work. And I want to mention just purely break the fourth wall just for a second. You and I are very busy right now. There's a lot going on behind the scenes of the Line. And a big part of it is the fact that we just what we announced, like at the Edmonton event, like there's been a lot of last minute planning going on for that. So this week has been a real scramble, I think, for us both. Mm-hmm. And a couple of days ago, I started getting messages going, Pierre did what? What did Pierre do? And I'm looking, and I'm like, I don't know. Like, I'm on a Zoom. Like, leave me alone. But what he ended up doing was part of an Atlantic Canadian tour. Pierre Poilievre visited a protest site on the Nova Scotia-New Brunswick border and posed for photos and chatted with the people at the protest site and made some remarks, which were caught on film, and then he left. And this sounds very banal.
And well, especially then we should know quickly, that the protest site was like an ongoing kind of blockade of kinds to protest the carbon tax.
Yeah, it's an encampment. It's, right, I don't think they blocked any roads, but it's enough. Like it roadside encampment with trailers. Okay. And driving by, the opposition leader jumped out. Now, I've put a very banal description on it. And then what ended up happening is that very quickly it was noted by people who watched the videos and had some familiarity with the people some of the people at this encampment site, and look, there's no term I'm going to use here that is not going to get me my balls busted either by the left or the right. But some of these people are on the political extreme in Canada. Some of them are apparently affiliated with the so-called Diagonalon. Is that
right? Diagonalon, something like that.
Diagonalon movement. Others are just sort of more sovereign citizen style, reject the authority of government types. And the fun thing about this, before we get into the political analysis of this, is that I had said to you in a text message, I guess, whenever the day this broke is, I can tell you immediately the exact people in this country by name who are going to say, isn't it great to see the opposition leader reaching out to politically disaffected people? And I can also tell you the exact same people in this country by name who are going to go, Pierre Poilievre might as well have just showed up in a Gestapo uniform, goose-stepped around the New Brunswick legislature for a while, flipped everybody off, and then gone home. Mm-hmm. And the honest answer, and I immediately, first of all, I sighed heavily. And I was like, oh, God. So I'm going to have to spend some time chasing this down this week. I immediately got on the phone with some Conservative Party sources, including some who are in the Poilievre inner circle. And my polite question to them was, hey, it's your buddy, Matt. What the fuck? And, you know, a couple of them tried to play coy for a while. Well, what do you mean? And I'm like, look, I laid out three options. I said, tell me if it's one, two, or three. Step one, political outreach because you want to firm up your right-wing vote flank. Step two, Pierre Poilievre has decided to come out as a fascist. Step three, he's trolling people. Where he knew exactly what he was doing, and he's doing it because he's got a 20-point lead, and he doesn't care if a segment of Twitter gets angry at him, and he's willing to piss people off because it amuses him.
There's an option four in that.
Well, and then I was told that it's option four. Fuck up. Where they're driving along, they see some people protesting taxes and stuff, and Poilievre, who, despite his current 20-point lead, I think if you talk to people who have known him, he is strategically smart, but sometimes tactically not, decided to jump out and pose for pictures. And they didn't do any advance vetting on who these people were. Had no idea about the symbology sketched on the side of the van, and then drove off. And I said to them, will there be an apology or a statement of any kind? And I was told the boss doesn't apologize. Admit he's wrong, doesn't apologize.
Can I, as I said, I don't necessarily want to take your sources at face value because it's totally possible that they're feeding you a line, right? Like, that's possible. Absolutely. But
everybody lies to me all the time.
Everybody lies. We have to assume that is a possibility. And that, in fact, this was some kind of attempt to firm up this aspect of the conservative base, in as much as it is an aspect of the conservative base. Do I confess that I think that option four is the most probable? And the reason why I think option four is the most probable just has to do with the way that what Pierre was saying on the tape that I saw and his behavior on the tape that I saw. I think that just what happened is, of course, we know that the conservatives have gone on hard on an axe, the carbon tax plank. He saw a bunch of people on the side of the road, his political
hard-working
Canadian people on the side of the road protesting the carbon thing. And he just saw this as an opportunity to essentially, what's the word I'm looking for? Glad hand and politic. Yeah. Because that's what he does. It's all he knows. It's his kind of his instinct. It's his métier. So he pulls over, he does the handstand. Nobody thinks twice about it. Nobody thinks to vet it. Nobody even really even, and also the other thing I would say is, like, a lot of the Diagonalon stuff, I think that people on the left in this country are oftentimes much more aware of the radicalism on the right than people on the right are, just as I think a lot of people on the right are much more aware or sensitive to the extremism on the left.
We're all blind to our own failings,
but I do think that we're also hypersensitized to the failings of others or to the extremism in others. I think that
Well, we have to be distracted by the failures of others, lest
true.
We might have
so
to.
So I think that also a lot of the people on the left are really, really hypersensitive to Diagonalon without realizing that like 99% of people who are within the conservative movement have no idea who these guys are. They don't care. You know what I mean? So it doesn't surprise me at all that Pierre Poilievre wouldn't have recognized Diaghilon. Like, I wouldn't recognize Diaghilon stuff. I'm not particularly clued into that. That's not an excuse. I do think a fuck up's a fuck up. And also, these are instincts that Pierre is going to have to learn to balance more effectively, because he shouldn't be hanging out with like Team Admiralty Law. But I don't see a Pierre Poilievre going into this particular encampment and being like, we're going to declare Admiralty Law. I see him going into this encampment and saying exactly what he says in totally mainstream rallies, which is, we're going to axe the tax. Nobody likes the tax. You know, so the idea that he thinks that this is a significant base of the Conservative Party that needs to be shored up or placated, that doesn't ring quite true to me just based on his own video. This does strike me as a fuck up of a more ordinary nature.
I offered them three possible explanations, and they gave me the fourth, which is, no, fuck up, didn't know what we were doing, walked into it, didn't do the research, people on the campaign didn't have the leader under control. Okay.
It's not great. But it's plausible.
If it's not that explanation, I vote option three.
Deliberate troll.
And you and I have talked about this before. We talked about this during mm-hmm. the MGTOW stuff. We talked about it for listeners who have no idea what I was just talking about. Someone analyzed the social media tags in Pierre Poilievre's videos and found tags which are designed to basically trigger search algorithms. And I know I'm trying to explain this in an accessible way and I'm making it worse, but basically you can bury data inside a social media post, like a photo or a movie, that isn't visible to the public, but helps search engines like Google find it. And some of the tags that were being plugged into Pierre Poilievre's material were affiliated with weird, dark internet subcultures.
I thought that was a total nothing burger of a story, because it sounded to me like somebody had just copied and pasted a whole, like a 100, 200 tags that were generally affiliated with conservative stuff.
And they were just
constantly putting the same tags into the tag fields as a matter of course. I don't think there was conscious thought behind that.
I think everybody went to Joe Rogan and, Ben Shapiro's YouTube videos, because they're very successful, copied all their tags and copied them into Pierre's. But if it's not that explanation, I think someone did it to go,
I don't buy that. That's too obscure. This is the most obvious answer for some of this.
The people doing this kind of coding are real comfortable.
I don't know, Matt. That's even that strikes me as a bit of a stretch. I honestly think that it's just more simple than that. They just had like a couple of hundred tags in a Google Doc somewhere that they knew were generally affiliated with conservative videos, and they were just putting it all in the same metadata.
That's my first bet. My second bet is troll. And I've been writing for years that most of the political parties, including the conservatives, are being run by the social media.
That's a problem. I think you're right. I think that instinct is a problem. Yeah. Conclusion is that there was an element of a couple of different failures from Pierre Poilievre's own, his own kind of political métier, his desire to glad hand, his desire to do the hustings walk. I think he likes doing that kind of stuff. And I think that there was also maybe an element of trolliness. I'm gonna engage in some of that. So yeah, I think the trolling, a degree of trolling strikes me as plausible, but perhaps not necessarily understanding the fire that he was playing with that troll, which again is going to be, I think, a criticism that.
He met the convoy. Like, the guy has a record of being like, whatever's going to piss the CBC.
Yeah.
I'm going to do.
I think this is a criticism we're going to come back to again and again with Pierre, is that you don't necessarily fully understand the fire that you're playing with. You know, it's one thing to go hang out with the sovereign citizens crowd. It's another thing to govern that crowd. Best of luck with that, because that's what you're going to have to wind up doing. And those people, when they start to realize that, you know, you are not going to abolish the Canadian state and reinstitute admiralty law, they're going to turn on you because they're going to see you as the exact same expression of power and authority that they're railing against today. Once somebody has lost faith in the state to govern them, they don't come back from that. That's gone. They're not going to change their mind when you're the governors. I just don't think that is something that this current conservative movement necessarily respects or understands. So I said, I think that that's something that we can put a pin in that, because I think this is going to be an ongoing and recurring theme in our criticism of Pierre Poilievre. But I do want to transition a little bit, because the liberal reaction to it.
Before we do, I just want to mention one thing. Can I just mention one thing? One of the things that jumped out about this to me, and I did tell my conservative friends this when I was buzzing them this week to ask them WTF. I said to them, guys, look, I know the boss leans into this kind of thing. I know he doesn't like to admit error. I know he doesn't like to apologize. That's human. And maybe it's a little more amped up in politicians than the rest of us, but it's human. I get it. But I also said, I told them straight up, and this is going to piss people off. It's going to piss everybody off. This is going to be one of those real unifying moments here, because I'm going to piss everybody off simultaneously. To the people who are really pissed off about this, who are convinced that this is Pierre Poilievre showing up with a red swastika armband, not a single vote is going to move because of this. The outrage of this is limited in the pre-existing echo chambers. Everyone who has an opinion of Pierre Poilievre already is going to reinforce it. No one, not a single mind in this country is going to change.
This is an extremely online story.
As I said, that's exactly it. Most people aren't going to care, but I did tell my conservative friends, you know, we're a couple days into this story and the PM is, you know, lamenting it, and the usual suspects on social media are declaring the second coming of Adolf Hitler and so on and so forth. But what I did say to my friends is that sooner or later, the boss is going to fuck up in a way he can't ignore. And this is not even a Pierre Poilievre specific comment, although I think it applies to him, but the comment is more broad. And the comment is that every politician needs to be controlled. Mm-hmm. There has got to be someone in their immediate loop who says to them, no, we have an event in the next town. We're not pulling off at the fucking roadside encampment so you can glad hand. And that is part of keeping a politician on schedule, but it is also keeping them out of areas that have not been vetted, people who have not been vetted. This is all part of the modern political arrangement. And earlier this week, I wrote a column about Chrystia Freeland and some of the comments she had made in reference to the really nasty anti-Semitic incidents in Ottawa last weekend. And one of the things I mentioned right at the part of the column, because it wasn't really the part I thought was most interesting, but I wanted to mention it right away, is that Freeland had said when she went out, I think it was Monday, she said, I hadn't seen the comments in Ottawa. If the deputy prime minister of the country is doing a media availability in a city, Montreal, with a large Jewish population on the eve of Passover, after an incident of overt anti-Semitism in the national capital, and Chrystia Freeland has not seen those comments yet, that is unfucking believable political negligence by her staff. Someone should be fired into the sun for that. And whoever was in the van and didn't tell Poilievre, no, we're not pulling over at the weirdo encampment.
Yeah, because I think to some extent, to some extent, politicians kind of need to be safe from their own worst instincts half the time. I think that's just they're in a bubble.
People think we're in a bubble. I don't have 30 staffers going around. Yeah, and not only that, but bluntly,
it's people who politicians are weird. The sort of people who are compelled to run for politics are weirdos. You're not. We're normaler than them, man. Like you don't see me signing up for that job, and for good reason. That job's hell. So like the sort of people who are compelled to do that kind of job are not normies, man. So you do need to have people around them who are a little bit more normal and grounded. Well, no, but I mean, I've made this argument about Justin Trudeau. How much better would the prime minister's office be right now if they hired some random retired farmer from Saskatchewan to just hang out with them, just be like with a trucker hat? I don't think you've thought this through.
Look,
like, you know what I mean? Like the entire prime minister's office would for the last 3 years would have been well served to get some like rando dude who is just completely normal, salt of the earth, typical voter, you know, a working class person in their prime minister's office just to bounce ideas off of, you know, and none of these politicians do that. They never surround themselves with people who challenge them. And it leads to bad instincts and bad political decisions every time. But anyway, I do want to transition to the next thing because I want to talk about how the liberals have responded to this drama. And I'm going to quote this from Justin Trudeau directly. Justin Trudeau says, quote.
Well, but first, there is one thing we have to do first, though, Jen, just for tradition's sake.
Like and subscribe to Line because we're the less weird weirdos. Anyway, I want to get this quote from Justin Trudeau in his response to all of this, and that is, quote, because that's exactly what Pierre Poilievre continues to do, not just when you see him engaging with members of Diaghilom, but also when he refuses to condemn and reject the endorsement of Alex Jones. For those who have not been following, Alex Jones put out a tweet this week that said something to the effect of, Pierre Poilievre is the real deal. He's saying everything that I agree with. Alex Jones is probably best known for being the guy who had to pay out, what, $1 billion in libel settlements because he said that the parents of who had lost children in the Sandy Hook massacre were crisis actors. He said it was fake. Yeah, and therefore the parents who had already lost their children in a horrible shooting accident were hounded for years and years and years by Alex Jones's followers and people claiming they were part of some kind of government conspiracy to fake a massacre so that the government would take away their guns. So
I think it's worth speaking 10 seconds here. Crisis actors is a term that floats around on social media that, used broadly, means that a lot of the events that are in the news have been staged, and the crisis actors are the people who show up and portray the traumatized crowd, the grieving widow, the parents whose child has been killed. Apparently, like according to the conspiracy, these things are being faked to advance a government agenda. So when, you know, when we use the term crisis actors, what he was accusing these parents of is basically being on the government payroll to portray grieving parents.
Yeah. And I mean, if you believe that, I would say that your attachment to consensus reality is so far gone that you should probably turn off this podcast now. You're not going to get what you're looking for from us here.
We've already mentioned Alex Jones, Jen. You know full well they're going to be in the comments.
Fair enough. Anyway, look, do I think it reflects well on Pierre Poilievre that Alex Jones is endorsing him? No, I don't. Do I think that Poilievre should respond to that in any way? Also, no, I don't. There's just nothing else to add. And then the other thing I would note to all of that is, so far the federal liberals have attempted to portray Poilievre as an extremist. Whether or not you think he's an extremist or not aside, this portrayal has not worked. The more they attempt to portray him as an extremist, the higher his polling approval gets. So
we warned him, Jen. We told him that the more they try to portray him as an extremist, the more he'll show up at events, even weird Diaghilom encampments or whatever it is, and he'll go, hey, let's axe the tax and build more houses. The more they try to link this guy to Donald Trump, the better Poilievre is going to look. And I'm not saying this as a Poilievre endorsement. I'm saying this as a warning to my progressive friends. You 100%. Are legitimizing him.
Yep.
You don't think you are, but you
are. The other thing that I would note is that by the lack of message discipline that the liberals consistently display on this stuff, they're like magpies. It's like, shiny thing, he did something crazy. Let's go for it. You know what we stopped talking about the second that Prime Minister started talking about Diaghilom, which is, again, a group that most people have never heard of, and Alex Jones. We stopped talking about the budget. Like, this budget was supposed to be their big strategic comeback budget where they were going to put all in on housing and they were going to start to turn things around and they were going to get the Youngs back. And literally that lasted, what, 4 or 5 days before you lost message discipline because you couldn't help yourself. What am I missing?
I think, well, I don't think you're missing anything, but I think it's two things. One of them is that I think, to your exact point, the budget didn't work. And the 2 weeks of pre-budget spending announcements didn't work. And I'm patient. You know, I've been doing this job a while now. I had hair when I started. You know, I'm very patient about this. To totally get a refreshed polling average slate, you need 2 or 3 weeks. Because some polls, you need 4 or 5 days to do them, and then they need to be processed, and then they're published. Every poll is capturing... Hey, look, you can rush a poll and get a pretty quick reaction to a breaking news issue. But in general, polls are a snapshot of how people felt a few days ago, maybe a week. And you get a couple of weeks of those in, and then all the polls that came out before the budget will be washed out of the rolling averages the aggregators use. So in two weeks after a budget, you get a pretty good sense of how it's landing. We're not there yet. We're a week and a half away.
Well, the other thing I would note in all that that's interesting to me is not only has the budget not led to the bump or the return, which, by the way, was a really weird thing to bet on, because budgets almost never do that. Budgets almost never lead to turnaround fortunes or bumps or anything of the kind. Well, I guess what else did you have?
That's the point, right? Like, you asked me why are they
this is probably why.
Object. They're down by 20. They have, like, they've been in a
spiral
in a sustained
for 2 years now. Almost.
Slump since.
Well, anyway, the other thing that I thought was interesting is that we have seen a word that we have Justin Trudeau. He's going to try and fight back, and we should expect Justin Trudeau to be showing up on more podcasts. We're waiting for our invitation to interview you, Mr. Trudeau. You are welcome to On the Line at any moment. We would be happy to have you. However, I would note that it seems really counterintuitive to me, if you were a liberal, to think that the problem is too little Trudeau, that the answer is that really you just need to get Trudeau out there going on podcasts like he did this week on a Vox podcast, saying things like, quote, all those things is why life is difficult right now. And the actual fact is, particularly when you compare us to other countries around the world, all those things have made life better in meaningful ways. And it would be much worse if we hadn't done those things. Justin Trudeau's approach to, fighting here, to making himself more available and more in front of people's faces, is having, I think, it's not having a positive bump effect, it's having a negative bump effect. The more he does these things, the more unpopular he gets. And part of that is because he's trying to do two things at once. He's trying to pivot against his own record, saying housing, immigration, all these sorts of things, everything's in the tank, I agree, it's shitty. But at the same time, taking no accountability for that record at the same time. Oh, and it's actually things aren't shitty at the same time. It's just that you've been misled. You are getting sidetracked by disinformation. Actually, things are great now. It's a really confusing mixed message. It's not doing the right things. And as a result, it just comes across as tone deaf and bizarre. And I think it's actually contributing to his lack of popularity. So if he's going to continue to do podcast shows, all of these sorts of things, he needs to pick a lane. Either Canada's broken and he broke it and he's going to fix it, or Canada's not broken, it's been doing great, and you should all just be thankful that he's been in office for this length of time, because the Conservatives would make it so much worse. You can do one lane or you can do the other lane. You can't do both lanes simultaneously. It's confused messaging. They're sure as hell going to try. I mean, I kind of respect it. But as I said, I'm quite serious. Yeah. If Justin Trudeau wants to come on the Line podcast, we'd be happy to have him.
I think, we'd be delighted to have him on the line. Two things I'll say in response to that. First, I might be increasingly in the minority on this one, but I still think Justin Trudeau is the Liberals' best bet in the 2000s.
They're increasingly running out of runway to replace him.
And the reason I also think he has a unique ability to win votes in the GTA in Montreal, that any of his replacements will trade one for the other. And I also think, to your point, he's a known quantity and anyone else might not have the time to get up to speed here. To be clear, I'm not saying he's going to win
the
next
election. That would be quite the bet. You'd be taking quite the odds on that one. In fact, I almost kind of encourage you to do it just because the odds are so out of whack.
The Liberal, you know what, tell you what. If one of our many fans out there would like to donate $100 to the line and put in the donation field for the bet, I will go bet that money. I will wager with someone else's money that Justin Trudeau wins.
Yeah, but a 10-to-1 odds, and then you'll cash the $1,000 check.
I will share the winnings with whoever spots.
I'm willing to bet that no one is going to take that offer up.
No, I don't think we're going to see that either. But I still think I understand the position the Liberals are in strategically. If they are going to make the choice that Trudeau is the guy to stay with, if only to hold off maybe a total collapse, and maybe that's their best case scenario. Maybe their best case scenario is, look, he saves the furniture in the GTA and Greater Montreal, and we have 60, 70, 80 seats to rebuild around as a really effective opposition. Whereas you take a bet on one or the other, you end up having some weird Kim Campbell thing happen and you end up with like 30 seats. So that's a possibility. The other thing I wanted to say, though, about, and it's more about the shiny objectism that you were talking about before. I want to underline this, and it's easy to say, but I think it's important to understand. Do not underestimate the degree to which liberals hate Pierre Poilievre.
Yes, there's just not enough of them anymore.
No, but I think in terms of, like you said, like the reaction, like why did they move off the budget? Because liberals hate Pierre Poilievre in much the same way that I've been warning conservatives for years. You hate Justin Trudeau too much. You aren't willing to take a look at the broader issues here. And I also think conservatives have continually underestimated Justin Trudeau because they hate him so much. There are a lot of conservatives out there who have no good explanation other than the CBC did it, why they keep losing to a stupid drama teacher. They can't recognize this guy's a fighter and he's effective in politics. Right now, liberals are making that same mistake. And I think I tell people this, you have to understand, I don't hate the people you hate as much as you. I hate my own people for my own reasons. Don't worry. Like I let the hate flow through me. But if you really, really, really hate someone,
you can't
see
the problem clearly anymore.
Hate
blinds your analytical capacities. Actually, this is something, it's an interesting...
That's why I think one thing that you and I both do
is we really cultivate a degree of emotional detachment, which makes us seem a little cyborgish to a lot of ordinary people. And I think a lot of partisans project their own emotional schemas onto us. They assume that because they're emotionally attached to this person or they hate this person, they like this person, that therefore we must be doing the same. We must also hate these people. I keep on trying to make this point and people don't believe me, but it's true. I don't dislike any of these people. I disagree with them sometime. Or dislike them all. That's a different quote. I don't have strong emotional reactions to any of these people. I'm sure I could have drinks with any of them. I might disagree with certain policies they do, or they might annoy me sometimes, but I've cultivated a degree of emotional detachment from them because I know the second you start hating these people, your capacity to see clearly, see their appeals, see their downsides, see their weaknesses and their strengths just warps. It just warps dramatically. And I think that when I've made mistakes as a journalist, it's because I've allowed my emotions to get the better of my brains, which is why I try and it's why I try to maintain when I do get angry about things, I try to get angry about things like plastic bags and not people. Like that's a good channel for emotional rage.
Someone said something to me recently, it was a few weeks ago. It was meant as a compliment, but I thought it was funny. Person said to me, and I won't even tell you what the issue is. They said to me, I agree with almost everything you write because you're very fair. They said to me, Matt, you're very fair. You approach everything with an open mind. You get the evidence. You make a persuasive, logical, fact-based argument. With the exception of this issue, you're just totally blinded by your emotion on this issue. I went, okay. I said, is it possible? I said, how invested are you in that issue? They're like, oh, really invested. And I'm like, so do you think it's possible that I'm actually
equally fair-minded? You're just projecting your emotional
board. You're sensitive on this issue.
Well, I don't want to say that we're like, immune to that. Like, it's not like I think we try to cultivate a degree of detachment, but we don't always succeed. But we fail. We fail sometimes for sure. So I don't want to say be like a superior being here. We're not. But I do think that we both understand that we serve a role in an ecosystem, and that role does require us to put some work into not getting emotionally invested, either positively or negatively, in individuals, right? And
can I say something to you that I think will surprise you or the listeners? Maybe you'll get it. I have come to like Justin Trudeau more over the years. Not in a political sense. I wouldn't vote for him. Not my kind of politician. But I've seen him handle some situations with a degree of, I would say, grace, including his recent family troubles. And I don't feel a lot of kinship with any of these people. I think they're all weirdos. But as a husband,
you can connect
as a father,
with him.
I wouldn't want to go through.
You can empathize. You can empathize with him. You can empathize
on a global stage, and that humanized him to me. And I also think his instincts in the pandemic, with some very notable exceptions, were largely right. And I think, and I can say this without endorsing a single one of his policies, I can make this comment neutrally. The guy has had nothing but historic curveballs thrown at him for the last 5 years. I can't think of another prime minister outside of the world wars who has had to deal with more wild bullshit outside of his control than
Justin. So thanks for that, Matt, because Trudeau, as a result of that diatribe, which was very thoughtful and sincere, we're going to get all kinds of down likes. Good. I very much expect to be ratioed. So, but
still not voting for the guy.
But I think that you, I think you have made the pitch for him to appear on the line, to be interviewed, and he will get a fair trial and a fair hearing. And on that note, do like.
And as owned and subsidized, yes, government journalists, obviously.
On that note, like, and we don't take government money. Like and subscribe the line. Matt, do you want to talk about your Twitter thread on protests, or shall we move on to the other subjects? Because we've been going on for some time now.
Yeah, I mean, I can talk about it briefly, just because I feel like we've kind of covered some of the ground already. So I mentioned already, it was a big part of that Chrystia Freeland column I wrote. Things got really ugly in Ottawa last weekend. So about 6 days ago when we're recording this, some overt anti-Semitism in the protests there. And I've also been keeping an eye. I hate watching campus politics. I fucking hate campus politics. Like, you want to know what you do with the students who are troublesome today? You wait 4 years.
Okay, but I mean, I made that argument, like, 10 years ago, and then all of a sudden campus politics became newsroom politics, and campus politics became HR politics and corporate politics. Like, you can make that point right up until the point that you can't make that point anymore.
I still think you can make the point. I think the failure was not of the students.
Well, that is clear. That's why we started the
But anyway, look. I've been looking. Yeah, I don't think the nature of the problem posed by the students changed. I think the nature of the institutions and their willingness to say the self-respect of the institutions
corroded and collapsed. Yeah,
we did it to ourselves. Honestly, like, that should be our civilizational engraved on our civilizational tombstone. We did it to ourselves. But I'm making the point about the protests, which is simply that I understand that a lot of people out there are horrified by what's happening in Gaza. I get it. And I know I don't get the, and I know people don't think I get it, but I get it. And I know that there's a lot of people out there who are genuinely morally horrified, or they've also spent probably about 45 seconds in their entire life thinking about the issue, and then they go order a Palestinian flag on Amazon and show up at a march. I get it. Youth is stupid. And I say this as a reformed, former stupid young person.
Which is another word of saying old person.
Increasingly, yeah. But I also think that there is an element within these protests that is overt, hard, anti-Semitic. Traditional, old school, blood libel Jew hatred. And I think too many people are bending over backwards to give these people political cover. Because when they see these protests, all they see are the nice, if maybe somewhat misguided, white kids waving Palestinian flags.
Or that they sincerely
and they're not
connect
willing
to the cause of Palestine.
They're not willing to take the violence and the calls for violence seriously. Because we don't like, we talked about this earlier, Jen, we're all blind to our own problems. And it reminded me of when I went to Ottawa in 2022 to cover the convoy, how much time I spent trying to tell people that this is not one monolithic movement, that you've got a lot of nice, maybe misguided people here who are very frustrated by either genuine government overreach, or at least arguably genuine government overreach with pandemic health measures, or, as I wrote at the time, they believe a lot of batshit crazy things. But they're not bad. They're not evil. They're not here to hurt anyone. But you've also got a real nasty hard edge embedded in that crowd. And I think when left-wing people looked at the convoy, all they saw was the Confederate flag. When left-wing people look at the Palestinian protests, all they see are the nice students protesting against the bombing of a food convoy. And on the right,
okay,
it
so
is
can I play devil's advocate
reversed.
With that particular Twitter thread a little bit? I think that I think,
yeah, anyway, and to your point,
I think it was interesting to watch the response to that, because I think the point you were trying to make and did make was you have to be able to call out your own side when you see bullshit. And I think that that is a very perennial and very reasonable position. How I think people are hearing that and responding to it was that you were drawing a moral equivalence between the trucker convoy and the Palestinian marches. And I'm not, and to play devil's advocate, I'm not sure that that moral equivalence stands. The trucker convoy had a really wide range of people. I think the people who are claiming that there was no risk of violence or none are wrong. We saw what happened in Coutts. Last week, we saw two people have now been, found guilty of, they were found guilty by a jury of engaging in illegal behavior. We know that there were stockpiles of weapons. Yeah, no, I mean, like, these people were the fringe of this broader movement. These were not, they didn't represent the majority of the movement, but there was a real risk of violence among some of them there, especially in Coutts there. I think your sources about the convoy during the time were concerned about a similar kind of fringe embedded in an otherwise peaceful protest in Ottawa. But we didn't see that fringe in evidence. They moved on, they got bored, they didn't whatever. That wasn't the case in Coutts. I think after Coutts they boogied it. But there was some of this stuff in Coutts. There was some of this in evidence. But what I'm saying on the Palestinian side, on the pro-Palestinian protesters, is it's not the odd fringe dude. They're openly chanting, "We support what happened on October 11th. And they're all joining in, man.
Yep.
Like, so to say that there's, and it's these sorts of calls for violence, open calls for violence, are happening repeatedly, consistently, across multiple cities, across multiple protests. It's again and again and again. That is not something we saw during the trucker convoy. The trucker convoy, there were definitely a couple of people who embedded in those convoys who were a hard edge side. I think that that's in evidence. In these convoys, when these Palestinian protests, we're seeing, as I said, repeated, consistent calls for violence and justifications of violence and open anti-Semitism again and again and again and again. Does that mean that 90% of the people in these protests are really just nice people? Maybe, but there's a certain point where you got to start asking some questions here. I would also say that there's also been some evidence that some of these protests are being organized by people who are funded by certain bad actors here in ways that I did not see evidence of that in the trucker convoy. I know there was talk about who was funding the trucker convoy, but there was never any significant evidence showing terrorist involvement. There is some evidence in that's come to light and been reported about in the Palestinian protests. So I'm not sure that, yes.
Of terrorist finance?
In fact, I believe Tristan Hopper did some things for the National Post a couple of months ago about how some of these protests had links to, I think, the Iranian guards and things like that. So I'll find the source and citation for that. But, you know, to draw these two protests and say that there's some kind of moral equivalence between the two of them, I think that that's a pretty debatable position, to be honest.
I don't even think we need, look, I mean, I don't disagree with that. I think in the bigger difference is we don't even need to focus on moral equivalence. Yeah. The protests are very different things. The Ottawa occupation was a fixed position in a government district that was a fairly small, hard number of set in static people that was joined by a broader transitory protest movement. It was a very different protest. The Palestinian protests in Canada have mostly been short duration events brought in and then dispersed. Like at the end of the evening, they disperse. The United States, it's a bit more different. I would be interested to learn more about who's in the encampments, because one of the things you've seen some of the schools saying is these aren't our students.
Well, and hold like, that thought, know, like, because we are going to have some reporting on that in very, very short order. So I don't want to get into that in too great depth. You're right. I'm not sure, but these are maybe not apples to apples comparisons.
The comparison that I want to make is that people are way too forgiving at the fanatics who agree with them. And they're really quick to jump all over the fanatics that don't and define an entire movement by them. all I'm asking for, and I've written a series of columns and
I just want an even standard. Anyway, on that note, like and subscribe to the to your fanatics here at the line. Look, I think we've got two more things to talk about. One, I want to be fairly brief because we've already gone on quite at some length. One is what is happening at the CBC, and then I don't know if you want me to give a very brief rundown about Crazy in Alberta. But Matt, do you want to explain to us what caught your eye at the CBC this week?
I'll be honest with you. I don't know what's going on.
Well, that's
going
to make for a very short segment, and that's now, isn't it? Something's going on. We're not sure what.
Yeah. No. Travis Denraj is he's not a friend of mine or anything. We don't know each other personally well at all. Friendly colleague, mm-hmm. I guess. I would describe him. And he's a CBC News television host. Canada Tonight, I think his show is called. Sorry, Travis, I should know that. But he hosts a TV show. And he, a couple of days ago, had tweeted that he had asked Catherine Tate.
There you go. Sorry, Carrie.
That's right. Sorry, Carrie. My bad. Catherine Tate, the president of the CBC. He'd asked her for an interview on the show, and she had denied it. And he tweeted that it was regrettable that she wouldn't come on and do the interview, because the CBC has been a subject of recent controversies regarding budgetary priorities, executive bonuses, questions about journalism standards, things like that. And he tweeted that his request had been denied. And then he disappeared. Hasn't been on the air. And I know that a segment with him appeared on the air. And I don't know if it was
also his
or not,
CBC his Twitter profile has suddenly been denuded of all CBC references. That's usually the sort of thing that happens right before we get a sad to announce tweet.
Well, let me. In fact, I'm clicking a link right now. I also noticed that his bio page on the CBC still exists. But his show page is now a dead link.
Let's not read too much into that. I know there's going to be some CBC Kremlinology going on there, but.
Well, I just clicked the link on my phone right now. I want to see what happened. I just clicked the link that will take me to his show page. His bio is still there. Clicking on the show page link.
Okay, so let's play some devil. I want to play devil's ad.
So his CBC bio exists.
So let's operate on, I think, a reasonable assumption that he's either been punished, at least punished, if not fired. Let's play devil's advocate with that idea. What kind of journalist organization can expect to criticize the leader of their organization and not suffer some kind of consequences? Which one?
Only one.
Why is that, Matt?
The CBC.
What is written right into their mandate?
And I pulled up a copy of the JSP, Journalism Standards and Practices. Line podcast listeners will never know this, but I would like to apologize to the video viewers because I'm going to be looking off camera for a minute while I read it verbatim. This is the relevant paragraph from the CBC Journalistic Standards and Practices document. Covering ourselves, that's the heading. Our standards do not change when the CBC or a CBC partner becomes the story. Public interest guides our choices. Although there is a potential conflict of interest, normal techniques of news gathering and decisions around the nature of coverage are the most useful way to ensure journalistic integrity. This means that there should be clear editorial separation between those reporting on the stories and those whose priority is it to protect the interests of the corporation or its partner. This also means that reporters and editors involved in the coverage must remove themselves from insider briefings relevant to this story. So the important part of that statement, I think, is right at the top. Our standards do not change when the CBC or a CBC partner becomes the story. If I am desperately trying to get someone to agree to an interview, or if I have offered someone an opportunity to comment and they have declined it, you are sure as shit going to see me note that publicly. I am going to tweet, comment in the article, mention on the air that I asked for an interview or asked for a comment.
Take note, Justin Trudeau, when you deny us your interview on the line. Fear, quake at the power of our Twitter following.
So I would say that what Travis tweeted about his boss denying him an interview. Would get you in trouble. Would get you in trouble at most news organizations, but it's right there in black and white. And tweeting when someone won't agree to do an interview with you.
So I got two observations here, and I don't want to get into this at great length because I actually have a big opus column about the CBC coming. Da, da, da. Don't worry, CBCers, you'll like it. But anyway, the rest of our audience may not. But you know, I don't need to be popular. I'm not here to be friends. We're going to be so disliked the next week or two. It's going to be great. Two observations. I can remember two recent interviews that Catherine Tate did with CBC reporters as part of trying to justify the CBC, get the importance of the CBC out there to listeners and such. My opinion in that both of those cases, her performance was extremely poor. She seemed to be coming into these. Firstly, I think in many of those cases, it puts the reporter in a really awkward spot. Because, of course, the reporter has to try and maintain a degree of neutrality and tries very hard to maintain a degree of neutrality and toughness with their boss. And that's really, really hard to do. I think Catherine Tate is much better served doing those kinds of interviews with a private media or independent media. But she chooses not to. She chooses to do this kind of PR in-house. I think that puts the reporters in question in really tough positions. But in both of these cases, I think the reporters did their jobs as well as they possibly could have in impossible circumstances. And it's clear to me it seemed from the tone to me in those performances that Tate was not expecting tough interviews and was kind of put out by the fact that the journalists were doing their job and being tough with her. So it doesn't surprise me that she would not want to continue with the strategy. She would not want to put herself out there for a tough interview, even among her own reporters. That doesn't surprise me. It doesn't speak well to her, but it doesn't surprise me. The second thing that I would observe, and this is a little tease ahead of the column that I'm trying to write, is a couple weeks ago I talked about being at the Canada Strong and Free Network conference in Ottawa. And of course, part of the reason why you go to these types of things is you go to the panel discussions, but the reason why you actually go to these things is to socialize afterwards. You want to hit the hospitality suites. You want to get FaceTime with people. You want to talk to people. You want to make sure they know who you are. Because especially in a conference like this, you're dealing with the future power brokers of what is likely to be the next government. Of course you want to be there. Of course, as journalists, you want to be be having drinks with these people and making sure they know who you are and chatting with them. Because duh. The other people who realized that they needed to be in that room was just about every single lobbyist in Ottawa was making the circuit at the CFCN conference because duh, including people who were not ideologically predisposed to conservative politics. For example, I ran into environmental lobbyists and people like this, anybody who wants to have a seat at a table in a government that's likely to come to power in the next 2 years knew that that's where you had to be that particular week.
Yeah. It's not even a seat at the table. You need someone inside the government who will remember that you bought them.
Or even if they don't necessarily agree with you or disagree with you, you want to create an actual human relationship with some of these people, right? Yeah. Yeah, correct. So and I mean, even me sitting down, I sat down with some very interesting people who have power and who will have power. And what I frequently got back to them was, well, I read you, but I don't always agree with you. And I'm like, well, good. You shouldn't always agree with me. I expect you to not always agree with me. That is excellent. But you know who I didn't see hitting any of those hospitality bars or seat circuits or any of this stuff? You know who I didn't see anywhere? Anyone from the senior levels of the CBC. I didn't see anyone from their board. I didn't see anyone. I didn't see Catherine Tate. I don't know. Maybe Catherine Tate had a better party in New York to go to that week. I mean, if your job is to try and make a case for yourself to the future conservative government, the likely future conservative government, you got to show up and you have to be willing to go into the den of the dragon and say, look, here's why I think we ought to continue to exist. And you got to be willing to take that shit. None of them were willing to, none of them either. They didn't know that they had to do that or they couldn't be arsed. And if I were an employee of the CBC, I'd be real, real goddamn pissed that the only one at the CFCN conference this year making a case for the CBC was Jen goddamn Gerson. Because where were your bosses? Where were your leaders? Like, I the more I thought about that, the more offended I got on behalf of the many thousands of very good journalists at the CBC who work very hard to do their jobs.
You were devil's advocating me earlier. Give me just a measure. Okay. First of all, I do want to say I do agree.
You don't have to.
I do agree with what you said there. No, I do. I do. But the problem is, I think as you noted about Justin Trudeau, the more he's trying to fight back, it is very possible he ends up digging himself a bigger hole. Given what we have seen from CBC management and senior executive leaders, I'm not convinced that anything they do in public is not going to be counterproductive.
Well, in public, I agree. Good at it. But I'm talking about in private. We all know politics. 10%. It's like it's an iceberg. 10% of what you see is what's happening above the surface.
Yeah. I don't generally assume that people who flail in public turn into social maestros in private.
At least try.
And
try.
I think you can criticize them for not trying, but I can also understand, and I've seen institutions get into this place before, whether it's a private business or a government or even an individual who feels besieged, they become convinced that the best thing they can do is say nothing and go to ground and it will go away. And I think in this case, that's wrong. But I think
but
that
when you
might
have a conservative opposition leader saying he's going to defund the CBC, you literally have nothing to lose at that point.
They've heard it before. The question is whether or not they believe it this time.
If they don't, they're making a very crucial miscalculation. And again, I ask you, why exactly are they making the executive paychecks then if they can't politically calculate that risk? I mean, that's part of their job. Like, I want to be really clear. I'm not giving any CBC reporter or journalist hell for not being at the CFCN conference. That was not... I don't expect them to advocate for themselves or for their jobs in that environment. That is not their job. That is senior executive management, to be able to assess political risks and engage with stakeholders appropriately according to those political risks. If you can't fundamentally do that, why do you have a senior role in that position? What do you do here, Bob? What do you do exactly here? To me, there's no excuse for that. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there was a senior CBC executive hitting up some hospitality street I didn't see. If they did, please drop me a line, jen@readtheline.ca. I'll be happy to apologize. I just didn't see. I saw environmental activists in those suites. I saw all kinds of people who understood very well, done the math on this, and realized that they needed to be there, at least trying to build some relationships, trying to build some FaceTime. I don't understand where the math was on that. But I think, as I said, if I were an employee or an ordinary journalist at the CBC, I would feel as if my senior leadership had failed me in that, and I would feel that that position is justified. So Catherine Tate deserves to be called out for that. She deserves to answer to her employees and also to the taxpayer who fund her for those decisions. I think that's justified.
Well, and I'll say in this before we ask people to like and subscribe is that if anyone at the CBC does want to correct Jen about that, by all means, and when you're doing it as a PS, please let me know about my inquiry into where Travis
is. We would like to see a picture of him with a newspaper with today's date. Thank you very much. Proof of life. Like and subscribe. Do we want to talk?
Alberta update. We got we've been talking a while, but you want to talk
quick
Alberta.
Wrap up Alberta. Quick so wrap two up. Things. One, the Alberta NDP leadership race had their first debate. I watched in earnest. It was very interesting to me. What I took away from that debate was the absolute star of that goddamn show was a woman named Jody Callahoo, sorry, I'm just going to get the name right here because I'm going to mess up her middle name. I'm sorry, Jody Callahoo Stonehouse. There we go. Jody Callahoo Stonehouse, who I think is a First Nations individual who, hello, I've got a joiner in here. I thought she was fantastic. She was by far the most polished individual on that stage. She had really good policy, really good delivery. To me, my takeaway from that particular debate was she was doing what Nahed Nenshi did to win back in 2010. And that was, she's far from behind, very, not exactly didn't have the profile of the other candidates, but just nailing it on the debate circuit. And I wonder if she was actually able to pull votes over. That was really interesting to me. Second thing I want to note, and as you can see, I've got a little cameo thing happening. James, do you want to say hi?
Hi.
Thank you. You're very cute. Now go to your room.
Okay, hey, but why do? But I can't remember why. We have to be quiet.
Because we have to be quiet because Mommy is recording her podcast, and other people are going to listen to this on YouTube.
But why do I have to be quiet?
Because they don't.
I'm filming your podcast.
Because they don't want to hear you right now. They want to hear me, even though you're very cute.
Okay.
Okay. So go play trains. I think we should just keep that in. Why does he have to be quiet when I'm doing my podcast? That's fair. That's legit. It's not my job to keep a man down. The other thing I wanted to note is that there's a lot of stuff coming out of the UCP now that are, to my mind, really over the line crazy shit. One is Bill 20, which they just announced. Again, I'm teasing this because we have a column coming out about it next week, so keep an eye on this on the line. But one of the things there's a couple things that are being proposed for what this bill, which I think would be fairly surprising in any kind of national context for a provincial government to be trying to do. One is that they're trying to take a considerable amount of power over the municipal councils. They want to give themselves the power to fire people from city council. They want to give themselves the power to overturn bylaws. And they want to also, of course, give themselves the power to sort of overturn municipal health orders. Couple of points. One is that for a government and a conservative movement that has traditionally believed that power best resides in the most local level of government possible, to see this government engage in the centralization of power in the provincial government, I think that is highly improper and inappropriate. Secondly, I mean, take the ability to fire council members. I have no problem with the provincial government giving citizens the ability to engage in recall legislation. I mean, we've seen an example of that in Calgary of late. But that power shouldn't reside in the provincial government. That power really properly resides with the voters who elected those councils, those representatives. The power to overturn bylaws. The last thing I want is a provincial government that is, say, for example, getting donations from developers to have the ability to overturn bylaws or have the ability to direct the city to engage in land use decisions. That's inappropriate centralization of power. And the ability to overturn health orders, I mean, we all know who that's playing to. Come on, the fuck now. You might be able to make a slight case for that for me, but it's not a strong one. And then this goes on top of other stuff that the provincial government is trying to do, is that, for example, they're trying to take control over the way that the federal government, federal grants and federal money is distributed across the provinces. And I can understand some of what they're doing. Like, I understand that, for example, they don't want to have a system where you can have a federal liberal government throwing $100 million into, say, you know, solar-powered bus stops in George Cahal's riding. Like, I can understand why they would want to cut off federal pork barrel money, essentially, and take a little bit more control of that. You might be able to make a case for that. Where you lose me is where we have the federal government trying to take control over things like SHRT grants, which are grants that the federal government gives for particular types of research within universities. No, there's no need for that. The federal government granting organization isn't a corrupt enterprise. Like, that's just silly. And the only reason for the provincial government for to even want to involve itself in that kind of thing is because they have a pretty overt ideological agenda and they want to control and have more control over the types of research that's coming out of the post-secondary education institutions, which I don't think that's appropriate. If the government wants to fund particular kinds of research, it can do that out of its own coffers and it can control that by all means. But to try and circumvent the federal granting organization, and by the way, a federal granting organization, which on the whole has actually a very good reputation, that doesn't seem appropriate to me. So I think that we're going to have a column coming out about some of that stuff. To me, it's a very, very, how should I say this, hypocritical set of moves coming from a group of people who would once consider themselves fairly libertarian-ish conservatives. And to me, it's also an inappropriate centralization of power in the provincial government. And I think it ought to be rightly criticized.
Mm-hmm. When I was in Calgary, I had joked with you, well, it was half a joke, that if you were going to give me too rough a ride about being the Laurentian from the center of the universe, I had a whole lot of retaliatory lines ready to go, and I only needed one or two of them. But there is something I have said about Albertans before to you and to other Albertans through you, and I'm going to repeat it here. No. You're not particularly conservative.
Yeah.
You just got cowboy hats.
Yeah, you're conservative in name, not in action.
This is extremely
nothing, there's nothing conservative about this
legislation. Because there's two big failures here. A basic conservative principle is that democratic accountability should rest as closely as possible to the electorate. Any provincial attempt to unseat a municipal candidate 100%. Is a complete perversion of that. It is just a fundamental failure to understand and respect the actual conservative view on democratic accountability. And furthermore, if a federal government wishes to use its tax revenues to support local initiatives through commercial contracts or municipal development deals, and another level of government tries to interpose itself between that, I, as a member of the public or as the owner of a business or as a local elected official, have the right to petition my federal government and for business. And the idea that another, and it could be business, right? It could be a contract. Like, I want to provide federal services to the duly elected government of Canada. Or it could be, I'm a local politician and I want those solar powered bus stops. And there's a federal program that may provide them and I want to get access to them. The idea that another level of government is going to stick itself between them is, again, once again, profoundly.
The other thing, too, is it exacerbates something that the provincial government complains about a lot, which is the equalization imbalance. So this is the idea that Albertans are paying more in taxes than it gets back in services. Okay, well how do you think that balance is going to be further affected when you're adding layers of bureaucracy toward the getting back side of that equation? Right? Like that doesn't fix anything. And I think to me, it really puts forward a concern that essentially you have a government that is not only steeling itself up against federal overreach, but is at the same time sort of trying to invoke some kind of quasi-sovereignty while becoming more authoritarian itself, or not authoritarian, I think is probably too strong a word, but while it's becoming more centralized and less accountable in its own dealings. Right, like if you want to make an argument that Alberta deserves the same level of sovereignty that Quebec does, which I mean Quebec's charted a path there, that's fine. But then the counterweight to that argument is that you, as a provincial government, need to demonstrate better governance, better self-control, better restraint than what you perceive to be an out of control or corrupt federal government. Are we seeing that with these kinds of bills, behaviors, and laws? I'm saying, no, it undermines your argument for a more sovereign and free Alberta to behave in this way.
Interference in federal contracts and municipal elections brought
to you
conservative
by your government.
Conservative government in the most conservative province
now.
In the country.
Come on now, guys. Anyway, I mean, we'll see how... Enjoy the cowboy hats.
Cowboy hats.
I said, I'm like and subscribe, except let's be honest here, this is not going to be our top liker. So we managed to piss off all the people who normally like us this week, but that's our.
Yeah, we've identified our key constituent groups and we have individually invited every last one. Oh,
we do love you though. Thank you very much for listening to us. That's about it. That's it. Please like and subscribe the line to make up for the unlikes, the downlikes that we are going to be dealing with, the tsunami of downlikes that we're going to be dealing between Alex Jones fans, Daniel Smith fans, conservatives, Diagonalon. Oh, it's going to be just a joy. So please save us from ourselves. Do for us what the politician handlers won't do for that. Do for their own bosses. Like and subscribe the line.
Like and subscribe.
Bye.
Have a good weekend, everybody. Talk to you soon.